This is Dr. James S. Spiegel in his teaching on Christian ethics. This is session number 3, Utilitarianism.
Okay, so let's begin our survey of major moral theories, and we'll begin with utilitarianism. Two most prominent philosophers when it comes to the history of utilitarian thought are Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. Bentham was really the founder of modern utilitarian thought, and John Stuart Mill, whose father was a good friend of Jeremy Bentham's, it's probably Mill who's the most well-known scholar who defended utilitarianism. It's a theory that goes back to the ancient philosopher Epicurus, who was a kind of hedonist, hedonism being the view that the ultimate good for human beings is pleasure, that we should maximize pleasure for ourselves as well as for others. And the utilitarian brand of hedonism, which was first developed by Bentham, affirms that central claim that happiness, human happiness, is the most pleasurable life. So Bentham, like Epicurus, thought that the best approach to ethics is to recognize that pleasure is the moral standard, okay? That is an objective fact, right? We experience things that are pleasurable and painful. There's a whole range of different kinds of pleasures as well as pains that we experience. And since this is something that's universally desired, everybody wants pleasure, wants to have a pleasurable life, then that seems to be a promising kind of standard for morality. What if everybody aimed to maximize pleasure for the greatest number of people? Wouldn't that lead to the most happy life for the most people? That's a basic intuition of utilitarianism. Classical utilitarianism, as it's often called, or ACT utilitarianism, applies this standard to each individual act or policy that we might consider endorsing or pursuing. So this is the claim that Jeremy Bentham makes, is that we should evaluate each action according to what he calls the principle of utility, which he says is the principle which approves or disapproves of every action according to the tendency which it appears to have to augment or diminish happiness. So that's a basic idea. One of the great strengths of utilitarian theory is that it's easy to understand. It's a very easily comprehended theory. We'll look at some other theories, and Kant and virtue ethics and social contract theory, natural law, and so on, that might have some more challenging concepts. But what could be more simple than this? Act in such a way as to promote pleasure and happiness, right? And try to avoid things that are painful and try to keep from causing other people pain. That's the basic idea here. Now, an important distinctive of Bentham's utilitarianism is that it affirms equal consideration for all. Anyone, any being, not just human beings, but any sentient being that can experience pleasure and pain, they need to be given due consideration, right? And no human being's pleasure or pain is more important than anybody else's. So there's a very egalitarian kind of commitment here. And that's appealing to a lot of us as well. Now, what distinguishes Bentham's utilitarianism from, say, the ancient hedonism of Epicurus is he develops what is called a pleasure-pain calculus. Now, he's living in the modern, early modern period where science is taking off and scientists are discovering the usefulness of mathematics for understanding our world, right? Now, Bentham decided that this could be very helpful when it comes to thinking about ethics. And let's make this as scientific as possible. So he develops this pleasure-pain calculus, where the pleasure or the pain of each action can be evaluated according to a number of criteria. And there are seven of them. One of them is intensity. We ask, how strong is the sensation? How intense is the pain or the pleasure? Duration, how long does the pleasure or the pain last? Certainty, how likely is it that taking the action will produce the pain or pleasure? Propinquity, there's a word that we don't hear much. But this has to do with how close in time the pleasure or the pain will follow. How soon will it happen? Fecundity, there's another uncommon term. That just has to do with whether, in this case, the pleasure or the pain will lead to other kinds of pleasures or pains, or whether the act in question will lead to other kinds of pleasures and pains. Purity, whether the pleasure or the pain is mixed with the opposite sensation. Will it be mostly pleasurable but also somewhat painful, or vice versa? Or is it entirely pleasurable or entirely painful? And then extent, that has to do with the number of people that will be affected. Bentham thought that you could basically assign numerical values, positive or negative, to each of these categories when considering whether taking a particular course of action is right. So suppose I need a book for a class I'm going to take. I can't afford it right now. So I'm thinking about stealing my neighbor's text. It's a $70 or $80 text. would that be an appropriate thing to do? Well, for me, it's going to cause maybe a little bit of pleasure. Hopefully, my conscience is such that it's going to bother me severely. That's painful. It's definitely going to cause pain for somebody else that will last a certain period of time, and it's certain that they will experience that pain immediately, and then also to some degree, a lasting way. Even if they get over it for several days, it's going to bother them. It'll probably lead to other pains as other people find out that person's book was stolen. That's going to disturb them psychologically. And so even my pleasure will be mixed, hopefully, again, if I have a conscience, with a certain amount of pain, knowing that bothered a lot of people. And so the extent there, to apply that seventh criterion, is significant, because people will find out about this. So it should be clear that I shouldn't steal this person's book. It's going to cause a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort psychologically for a lot of people, and it's not going to bring me very much pleasure at all. So you know what? I should probably just buy the book or borrow it, check it out from a library or something. Well, that's a pretty easy case. But the same pleasure-pain calculus can be applied to much more challenging moral issues. And that's where Bentham thinks this is really the most promising route we have for discovering moral truth. And again, back to the egalitarian thing in terms of the applicability of the usefulness of this calculus for, you know, measuring pleasures and pains and determining overall happiness, we can apply this to animals as well, which in Bentham's day, that would not have been very interesting or of much concern to very many people. But to those of us today, we recognize that, you know, animal welfare is an important thing. Anybody who's had a pet knows that a cat, a dog, goat, chickens, cows, they feel pain, they experience pain and pleasure, and so they deserve a certain regard. Now, from a certainly a Christian theological standpoint, a biblical standpoint, we know only human beings are made in the image of God. So the value of an animal is far less than humans, but they are valuable nonetheless, and their pain and their pleasure matters. So this is one of the assets or strengths of the utilitarian theory, is that it has a place for considering animals and their pain and pleasure, and recognizing that we need to have some sort of moral regard for them. So many point to Bentham as the historical origin of what today we call the animal rights movement or animal welfare movement. Speaking of animals, one of the major criticisms of utilitarian theory is that it is a doctrine worthy of swine, right? to maintain that human beings have no higher good than pleasure puts us on the same level as, say, a pig, right? Whose pleasures in life involve eating, mating, and wallowing in mud. What is it that pigs find pleasurable? You know, it's brute pleasures like that. Surely human beings are at a higher level than animals, even, you know, philosophers generally recognize this. But to identify the human good as just a matter of pleasure, many argued in Bentham's day, in Mill's day, that really is demeaning to human beings. So John Stuart Mill, who was the successor to Bentham as the major proponent, major philosophical proponent of utilitarian theory, he critiqued or replied to this objection by saying that the criticism itself represents human nature in a degrading light because it supposes, as he puts it, that human beings are capable of no pleasures except those of which swine are capable. But the fact is that human beings have higher pleasures, qualitatively superior pleasures. Why? Because we have higher faculties. We have cognitive abilities that pigs don't have, that other mammals don't have. We have emotional capacities, relational capacities that these animals don't have. And that needs to be built into this theory somehow. And so Mill defends what has since been called a qualitative hedonism. That is an advance on Bentham's version of the theory. We have these other kinds of pleasures, not just pleasures of sensation, but also pleasures of the intellect and the emotion and imagination and even moral pleasures, right? We get a sort of joy and satisfaction out of seeing justice being done. No dog experiences that. No dog enjoys a chess game, right? I love the game of chess. I like certain other games like Settlers of Catan or playing poker, right? Those are intellectual pleasures. The intellectual pleasure of reading a book, right? Seeing a good film. As intelligent as my dog Austin is, she cannot experience the pleasure of chess or a board game or poker. So these are higher pleasures that human beings have that animals don't have. This raises the question, well, how do you know which pleasures are qualitatively superior to other pleasures? Mill's qualitative test here is that, as he puts it, of two pleasures, if there be one to which all or almost all who have experience of both give a decided preference, irrespective of any feeling of moral obligation to prefer it, that is the more desirable pleasure. So this is how we can decide which pleasures are better or superior to others. If you ask me, what is a superior pleasure? The pleasure of reading a book by Dostoevsky or eating a plate of spaghetti? As good as, say, my wife's spaghetti is, it doesn't compare to the pleasure I get reading Brothers Karamazov. It's a higher pleasure. reading poetry as opposed to playing a video game. I get a lot of pushback from students on that one. But I'd say the higher pleasure, assuming the poetry is excellent, the poetry of a John Donne or a William Shakespeare, that would be a superior pleasure to whatever pleasure you might get playing, say, Grand Theft Auto or some video game. Okay, so people who have experienced both kinds of pleasures would consistently give these responses. Mill says, that's how you know which pleasures are best. So it's for this reason that Mill says, as he puts it, it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig is of a different opinion, it's because they only know their side of the question. Okay. There's a number of factors regarding the human experience because of our intellect, our emotions, that even when we're feeling bad, it is a qualitatively superior state just because we have these higher capacities. Now, that might be debatable or even controversial in certain circles these days, to make this claim about the superiority of human beings. That was Mill's view. But his main point here is that there are certain kinds of pleasures that are superior just because of their quality. Now, an objection that some make here is that what about people who say no thank you to higher pleasures and then pursue lower pleasures? What do you say about people who just spend all their time playing video games and they don't read books at all? They're not even interested in great film. Or people who would just eat junk food and say no thank you to fine cuisine. Not interested, I'd rather just eat my fast food burger and fries again. There are plenty of examples of people who prefer these lower pleasures to the higher pleasures. What does Mill have to say to that? He says that that demonstrates a certain infirmity of character, a loss of the capacity to enjoy higher pleasures, or at least a loss of the capacity to appreciate the higher pleasures for what they are because of an addiction to lower pleasures. It is possible to get addicted to sodas, to fast food, to potato chips, to candy bars, or all sorts of sugary foods. I sometimes at the grocery store see people buy, you know, huge quantities of Mountain Dew and all sorts of chips and cheese balls and whatnot, and they say, wow, they really are addicted to this unhealthy food. Mill would say that's an infirmity of character there. And so it goes, that is human nature, we're prone to all sorts of addictions. The problem is with us in that case, it's not a problem with his theory or his view. In fact, higher pleasure should be preferred, and if we are preferring these lower pleasures, the problem's with us, not with his theory. He has some things to say about the satisfied life, what it means to to be a truly happy person. The two main constituents of a satisfied life are excitement and tranquility. A happy life, a balanced happy life, will be one which is characterized by mostly tranquility, you know, peace and harmony in our lives with occasional experiences of excitement. You don't want too much excitement in your life. Your central nervous system cannot stand that. You want mostly tranquility, minimal pain, and then periods of excitement. And the two principal causes of an unsatisfied life, he says, are selfishness and the lack of mental cultivation. It's an interesting analysis there. That the problem with people who are unsatisfied in most cases, or in many cases, he would say, it's because they're selfish. They're not attending to other people's needs as much as they should, or they have not developed themselves cognitively. They haven't cultivated their minds as much as they should. If you're doing both of those things, you certainly will not be bored. And you will find satisfaction in your life. He says, a cultivated mind, a mind taught to exercise its faculties, finds sources of inexhaustible interest in all that surrounds it. Okay? And isn't this true? People who are well-read, who are very learned about all sorts of topics, they're going to find more stimulation in their daily life and experiences than the people who are not. If you have more interests, then you're a lot less likely to be bored. And it makes you more helpful to other people. He says that in a certain amount of mental culture sufficient for, you know, significant contemplation about the world should be the inheritance of everyone born in a civilized country. So he would very much emphasize the importance of education for making people more happy, more satisfied. He believes that mental culture is a cure of social ills. Mill was very confident, as many scholars were in the modern period, that eventually we could solve the poverty problem and we can eliminate all disease. Those are the two main problems that face us. He says poverty to the point of suffering may be completely extinguished by the wisdom of society combined with the good sense and providence of individuals. Even disease can eventually be conquered through the advance of medicine and scientific technology. It's an interesting thing to note, given that since Mill's day, it seems like we've at least identified, you know, hundreds of more diseases than were known in Mill's day. Now we know that just because of the way viruses work and mutate, that viral infections, viral diseases, do multiply from year to year. So I wonder if Mill would have been that sanguine about the possibility of eliminating all disease if he knew what we know today about epidemiology. So that's basically the utilitarian theory as advanced by Bentham and Mill. Each person should be acting at all times in such a way as to maximize pleasure for everyone who's affected by their actions. That's the kind of the core idea here. And if everybody did that, then human beings would be as happy as we can be in this world. And so this remains a highly influential maybe the most popular philosophical moral theory. So what are the problems with this theory? Here are a number of major criticisms that have been brought against utilitarianism. One of these is the problem of application. How can we know for certain what the consequences of a given action will be? If I decide to perform the action, how will it affect people? To what degree will people experience pleasure and or pain as a result of it? The problem is, as human beings, we're not omniscient, right? We don't know for certain how things will go. Even in many cases when we think an outcome is fairly predictable, we turn out to be wrong. Oh, I didn't expect that. Or if I'd have known that was going to happen, I wouldn't have done it. How many times have we said that? If I'd only known. So not only can we not predict the future, we have a very limited awareness of the present and the past. But utilitarianism is depending upon our ability to judge from what we have experienced so far what the outcomes of a given action will be. Now, Mill says in response to this that we have learned enough from prior experience that, for the most part, we can predict what the outcomes will be regarding a particular choice. Well, that may be true, but again, as we've all experienced, and because of the limits of our understanding regarding this particular situation I'm in, our prognosticating abilities are very limited, and they are fallible. So future or forward-looking is very difficult at times, particularly when it concerns controversial issues. So that's the problem of application. Another problem is the problem of justice. So utilitarianism depends upon forward-looking, and that's difficult. It's a problem of application. The problem of justice occurs because utilitarianism is only forward-looking. And because it's only forward-looking, it's consequentialist kind of theory. It's a theory that judges right and wrong based on the consequences of actions. Because it's only forward-looking, it actually faces problems of injustice in the sense that it seems that it can permit unjust actions and policies that apparently can be justified, at least at a local level, because there could be situations where injustices produce more pleasure than pain. So this is a classic criticism of utilitarian theory, that it could, in certain circumstances, justify slavery. So when I'm teaching on this issue in a particular class of, say, 30 students, I will sometimes ask if anybody is celebrating a birthday this week or within the next 2 weeks. And usually one, maybe two hands go up. In a class of 30, good. Two hands go up, and it's Joe and it's Jane. And what I've just done and getting them to raise their hands as I've selected our slaves in a very random way, right? When their birthdays are is about as random as it gets. And they're going to be our slaves in this community of 30 people, and they're going to do all of the cooking. They're going to do all of the laundry. They're going to make sure that our cars are functioning properly, you know, make sure the oil is changed in each of our cars. They're going to take care of the various issues in our compound in terms of changing light bulbs and so on. That's what they're going to do, 10 hours a day, every day, and we'll let them relax Sunday afternoons, say, from, you know, lunch to dinner time. That'll be their little respite from what is otherwise constant toil. But we will make sure they get adequately fed, they have decent sleeping quarters, so it's not like they're in pain all day long. They're working hard, but you know, the rest of us are working hard. It's just that they are designated to work for us. Okay, so they are our servants, and that makes them slaves. Now, would that produce more pleasure than pain in this community? Well, many would argue that actually, yes. Because suppose we did some sort of pleasure-pain calculus. The overall pleasure value improves for all of us. Man, if I didn't have to worry about my laundry, that'd be great. I don't have to worry about making my own food, that'd be great. That, I consider that like on a scale from 1 to 10 plus 3, 4, or 5. And if all the other people, the other 28 people in our community, make that same judgment, you know, that multiplies out pretty favorably for pro-slavery in this situation. How much pain is it causing those two slaves? Well, okay, let's say it's significant in that just this daily toil and not having to have, you know, an exciting private life. I guess they could still go out at night. We could say, yeah, you can have a social life at night after you've done dinner and cleaned all our dishes. So they get that, and we're treating them kindly, right? Again, they're clothed, they're well-fed, adequately rested. But it's still going to be negative. Maybe it's, let's say it's negative 7, 8, 9, even 10 for each of them. That's still going to be more than compensated for by all of the pleasure that the rest of us are experiencing. So for that reason, the utilitarian could, and in fact utilitarians have argued, in defense of slavery down through the years. But if you believe that slavery is unjust, as hopefully you believe, you recognize that even if more pleasure than pain is produced here, it's still problematic, right? Because things can be unjust and a violation of human rights, such that maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain is irrelevant. But utilitarianism is blind to this because it's only concerned about consequences. It's not concerned about justice and rights. There's no place in this theory for considerations of justice and rights. That's another major problem that has been highlighted in utilitarian theory. The problem of rights, speaking of that, is well illustrated with the Peeping Tom scenario. Utilitarianism cannot adequately account for, say, the right of privacy a person has that's violated by someone who stealthily watches them, say, through a window in their private moments. If the Peeping Tom is very deft and can pull this off without the person knowing that they're being viewed, then that Peeping Tom's getting a lot of pleasure. And the person who's being victimized here doesn't know it. They're not experiencing any pain. So from a utilitarian standpoint, it seems like that's defensible. But hopefully, most of us would say, that's still wrong, even though the consequences are such that the person's experiencing more pleasure here. That's not enough to overcome the problem of the violation of rights involved here. And that, again, shows a serious limitation with utilitarianism because it only pays attention to consequences, pleasures and pains, doesn't pay adequate, really, any attention to the consideration of rights here any more than justice And then finally, there's what's called the problem of demands. If it is always our responsibility to maximize pleasure and minimize pain in every case, then the demands on us as morally serious people become overwhelming. That means you and I need to stop to help each person we see on the side of the road, you know, who's got car trouble. That means you and I need to use only the amount of clothes and other property that's necessary for us to have, you know, a decent life. The rest we should be giving to the poor. Any expendable income we need to be giving to the poor. All our free time in any given day should not be spent in leisure when we can be maximizing pleasure and reducing the pain of other people. And that means we should not train ourselves on a musical instrument. Think about all the hundreds, thousands of hours that are spent by someone who's becoming classically trained as a pianist or a cello player that could have been spent working at a soup kitchen or helping the poor in some way. So it becomes irresponsible to develop a serious athletic talent or an artistic talent. That is a problem for utilitarianism, because most of us would say, hopefully, that it is a morally appropriate thing to train to be a good musician or to be a good athlete, even though those things are not essential to human life and survival. But the utilitarian says, the utilitarian at least implies that those things would not be responsible because they're not maximizing our ability to promote pleasure and reduce pain. So because this is so unreasonable, this has been identified by many scholars as a serious problem with utilitarianism. The problem here, kind of root difficulty that leads to this implication with utilitarianism is it doesn't adequately distinguish between obligatory acts and supererogatory acts. Okay, this is the distinction between what we have a duty to do and those things, on the other hand, which are good but are not obligatory. They're above and beyond the call of duty. That's what supererogatory acts are. They're above and beyond the call of duty. Utilitarianism does not adequately draw that distinction, and that's what leads to this problem of demands. So those are four major problems with classical utilitarianism. Another version of utilitarianism, known as rule utilitarianism, aims to overcome these problems, and just might do so when it comes to the problem of application, problem of justice, maybe, problem of rights. And the approach that the rule utilitarian offers is to say that let's not make our moral decisions focusing on individual acts. Let's not assess individual acts with the principle of utility. Rather, let's evaluate rules, general rules for living, and assess those rules according to whether, if followed, they will lead to more pleasure than pain. That's the rule utilitarian idea. Live by those rules which, if followed, would result in the greatest pleasure for the greatest number of people. Now, this is a theory that has been defended. Various versions of this theory have been defended many of which fall into the general category of social contract ethics. And we'll talk about social contract theory later. The social contractarian says we should set up all of society in such a way that there are certain basic rules that we should all abide by. And we just select those rules which, if followed, will maximize pleasure in a society. We live in such a society. We have a social contract, and it's called the U.S. Constitution. We have a Bill of Rights, right? And there are just all sorts of rules there that are spelled out that our founding fathers decided that if we organize our society accordingly, it's going to give us our best chance at widespread happiness. So that's kind of an application of rule utilitarianism. But there are other forms as well. But later on, we will, in a separate lecture, we'll talk about social contract ethics. But that does it for utilitarianism.
This is Dr. James S. Spiegel in his teaching on Christian ethics. This is session number 3, Utilitarianism.